Before we jump into this interview, I wanted to make mention of the fact that the interview that we're presenting is designed to provide accurate and helpful information regarding whatever the subject matter is that's being covered. But we're making this available with the understanding that we're not endeavoring to be offering specific legal, accounting, medical, financial, psychological, or other professional services. Laws and regulations are continually changing, and they can vary according to location and time. So we're just not wanting to make any kind of representation that the information here that we're offering is applicable for all locations and times. And if you need legal advice, medical advice, psychological advice, accounting advice, or whatever, obviously we want you to seek out the services of competent professionals in the area of need. But we hope this is very helpful to you, and we wish you the very best as you listen. God bless you. Well, thank you for joining us for part two of this series on personality disorders. We have Dr. Doty in the studio again, and I really enjoyed the first session. I think the issues that we discussed about borderline personality disorders and antisocial and narcissistic are, to me, they're pretty riveting, because just the more you go through life and the more you realize that we can deal with difficult people, and sometimes maybe we ourselves have issues that need to be addressed. I've really come to appreciate a number of ministers I've interacted with lately who are really searching their own heart just to make sure that, you know, they're healthy emotionally and the way they relate to people, and that they're not, you know, ministering out of past hurts or, you know, past dysfunctional issues in their life. So there are some other areas that we want to look at, but at the end of this session, and you had a wonderful suggestion before we began recording, that we want to take some time at the end to really address what do we do when we're working with people. What are the practical steps of once we've identified that a person is really a troubled individual? And one thing I've seen, I've seen this in churches where people are just kind of written off and, you know, cast away, when maybe they really should not be, that there needs to be some understanding. There needs to be, you know, perhaps some boundaries, but they need to be brought into a healing community, not just cast out on a garbage heap of sorts. So I think that's going to be really helpful when you can share some thoughts on that. But some other personality disorders that we might see in the church.
Well, one of the ones that you probably have even seen a reality show developed around, you know, is the phenomenon of hoarding. And at this particular point, we classify hoarding as a kind of subset of obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Obsessive compulsive personality disorder is when people get locked into a particular way of thinking and they cannot seem to shake out of that way of thinking. And most people who have this disorder don't see themselves as having disorder. But a hoarder, for instance, I mean, again, television shows have gone into the homes and filmed what the home of a person with this disorder might have. Stacks and stacks and stacks of junk and trash and whatever that this person believes is of value to them. I, you know, had a person tell me about their mother's house in which they had hundreds of empty pizza boxes from pizza delivery that they would never throw away. They saved every one of them. That literally people end up having to, you know, rent storage sheds to store their junk. And really, it's filled with nothing but trash. A physician who had obsessive compulsive personality disorder saved every journal, every newsletter he ever received from any of his professional associations. And when all of the bookshelves and all of the closets were filled, they simply began to be piled in piles, literally from the floor to the ceiling, all along all of the walls of the house and all of the hallways of the house, making it difficult to get down the hallway. Now, that's one form of obsessive compulsive disorder. The other forms are...
That's way beyond being a pack rat.
That's way beyond, way, way beyond. And literally, those places are health hazards, and adult protective services will sometimes come into the home of elderly people who have this disorder and find that they're living in filth and squalor, mm-hmm. and they're really a danger to themselves. And so, you know, social services have to step in, you know, in order to get them out of those kinds of unhealthy environments. Other ways that people manifest this disorder is that they may have odd and eccentric behavior that they repeat. And so collecting is one thing, hoarding, you know, that kind of thing is one way that this manifests itself. But sometimes people just think in very odd and strange ways. They perform certain rituals. They may seem as though they are extremely superstitious. And that's another way that this disorder, you know, manifests itself. People with this disorder may live their life in an extremely rigid manner. And so everything they do is according to a set of rules. Mm-hmm. And to get out of, to break the habit is extremely distressing. Mm-hmm. Some of this behavior seems to be designed to keep anxiety or distress at a fairly low level. But anything mm-hmm. out of the ordinary causes some extreme distress. Mm-hmm. And again, what we are likely to find is that these are not people who aspire typically to leadership or, you know, whatever. They tend to be in the background. They tend to be even secretive about the way they live their life. And the way these people come to our attention is brought to us by family members who are concerned for them, or friends and neighbors who figure out what's going on in their life and then may alert mm-hmm. helping people to the level of distress and even squalor that a person might be living in.
Monk, you know, the television
yes.
show Monk. That's obviously a Hollywood version. It's cute. He's solving all these incredible crimes that no one else can solve. How true to life, how manipulated is that by Hollywood just for a good television show?
It's great entertainment. It's got some humor in it. But most of the people I see with this disorder don't have a lot of humor about them.
Okay, it's distressing.
It's just a very sad situation. An example that makes the news is when the SPCA or the animal control people are called to the home of a person who hoards animals. And so they may have 100 cats, and you can imagine the filth and how dirty the situation would be. And so sometimes people want to rescue animals who have this disorder. Now, that's not to suggest by any stretch of the imagination that there aren't healthy people who rescue animals.
Right.
But people with this disorder take in animals until finally they cannot care for them, and ultimately end up creating a harmful situation even for the animals they attempt to rescue.
Mm-hmm. Now, how different is this from when I think of obsessive compulsive things, I think of somebody who incessantly washes their hands. Is that
probably not this disorder? There is another obsessive compulsive disorder. We literally have two disorders with similar names in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. So one is obsessive compulsive disorder. One is obsessive compulsive personality disorder. So back to the definition of personality disorder. It's lifelong. These are people who have functioned like this pretty much their entire life. They've never thrown away a paper from even grade school, possibly. Mm-hmm. So they collect and hoard and, you know, whatever. So it's been going on a very long time. People with obsessive compulsive disorder, not the personality disorder version, may not have hoarding, may not hoard. They may not necessarily even collect. They simply may be highly organized. Their organization, though, often causes them distress that they try to control things that they can't control. The obsessive hand washing thing is probably the behavior of the not personality version.
Okay.
And many times those people have a little bit of insight into the fact that their anxieties get out of control. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of healthy, high-functioning people with obsessive-compulsive disorder. People with the personality disorder don't tend to be high-functioning people.
And they wouldn't think they have a problem.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. The obsessive-compulsive disorder has a little bit of insight. The personality disorder often has virtually no insight, may be highly defensive, may be guarded, and may, in fact, be very secretive about their life. Mm-hmm. Suspecting that there may be scrutiny if others knew.
Okay. So the person who recognizes they've got a problem and it causes them, family members, some level of distress, and they realize, for example, there's certain rituals that they do. Someone recently told me, a very highly functioning person told me recently that, you know, every time he locks a door, he'll have to go back and check it multiple times. And then even then, he still wants to check it one more time. And he recognizes, you know, I shouldn't be doing this, but he just seems, you know, kind of compelled and driven toward it. What kind of help, what kind of treatment is available?
For the not personality disorder version, the obsessive compulsive disorder, there literally are medicines that are highly effective at helping. It falls into the category of an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And so there's this inner driven anxiety. I sometimes use the example of it's like the hamster that's on the wheel, and the hamster keeps running and running and running and running and never gets tired of running, you know, and that's what happens inside the mind of a person with obsessive compulsive disorder. They get a thought going and they can't turn it off. It just keeps going and going and going. So I leave my house and then I worry, did I turn the oven off? I have to go back to check, you know, or didn't lock the door, so I check. But then I get down the street and I wonder, well, did I check all the doors, or, you know, maybe I missed it. I mean, and so they begin to question themselves. It used to be that to have this disorder, you had to have both obsession and compulsion. There had to be obsession. That was the mental, you know, continuing a thought without being able to get it out of your mind. The thought that I'm going to die. The thought that I might not be saved. The thought that my hands are dirty and I'm going to, you know, give myself some disease because I haven't adequately washed my hands. And so literally some of these people will have not only the obsession, but then the compulsive behavior, the acting out, doing something about it. And so some people will wash their hands 40, 50, 60 times a day until they've literally washed the skin off their hands. And so, and again, all of these things come in levels of severity. Some people aren't as incapacitated as others. Some people have mild cases of it. Mm-hmm. And so a mild case would be a person, for instance, who often worries about their physical health. They can go to a doctor. They can be checked out. They can be assured that they seem to have no symptoms of any disease. They have a complete checkup or whatever, but they're still afraid that there's something that the doctor didn't find that's going to ultimately kill me. And so they worry themselves sick.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned there's medicine for this?
Yes.
Okay. Effective?
Yes. Now, again, we see people with varying degrees of severity of this. So some people with milder forms are obviously going to respond probably the best to medicine. Mild to moderate forms of this, medicine tends to decrease the psychological distress. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely a biological component to this disorder. Mm.
So it's not just a person having a lack of faith or lack of spirituality or something like that. There's actually a brain functioning issue at stake here,
right,
at hand.
And in fact, probably most pastors have counseled people with this disorder because one of the common areas of distress is I may have committed the unpardonable sin. I may have lost my salvation. I walk the aisle of my church and I confess Jesus to be Lord, but I'm not sure I'm saved. Mm-hmm. And so there's this obsession about salvation. Mm-hmm. And you go through the scripture with them and you reassure them from the scripture that they did all the necessary things. And before the hour is over, they're right back where they were at the beginning of the hour. So they are not getting, they're not receiving, and they're not able to internalize the reassurance that they're being given.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got so many others to cover. Which of these do you want to tackle first? The histrionic, the avoidant, the dependent, the passive aggressive?
Some of these
the
we can go through pretty quick, I think, Tony, because a dependent personality disorder, that one's pretty self-explanatory. And if you ever saw the movie What About Bob?
Oh, my.
You saw an example of the dependent personality disorder. You know, and so here's this character who follows his psychiatrist to his home. He follows him on vacation. It's a funny story, but it's really in reality, again, this is a pretty sad story. People simply cannot function or believe they cannot function without others' assistance. Mm-hmm. And so they lock on to people. They, you know, identify someone that is helpful to them, and then they need their that helpful person's advice about everything in life. And if you allowed them to make an appointment as often as they would like, they would be probably in your office several times a day.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get enough. And the more that you assure them and give to them and show compassion to them, sometimes the more dependent they become.
Mm-hmm. I've heard pastors describe certain individuals that they try to help. And they say this compassionately, but they say it's like pouring water into a bucket that has a hole in it, that they just can't ever fill the bucket.
Right. I think that's a great example. Both obsessive compulsive and this dependent personality disorder are not helped by insight. They are not helped much by reassurance or shows of demonstration of compassion or what have you. And I think that's when you know you're dealing with a personality disorder. When you give the counsel that would have been helpful to most other people, to people with these disorders, they don't seem to be helped by it. And they're right back in the same condition they were in moments before. And so it doesn't hold, it doesn't stick, it doesn't last. And they're simply not able to offer themselves the same kind of reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, a personality disorder, this is lifelong. This has been going on throughout one's life. And it may be that it was early deprivation. I mean, I'm not a real psychoanalytically oriented person, and I don't, for the most part, look for an answer to everything back in your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But personality disorders is one category where that, though, is often the case,
mm-hmm.
that there are sometimes identifiable traumas and abuse and neglect and severe circumstances where these behaviors develop. We've just had a horrible tragedy in Haiti where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Parents of small children have been killed. And so now we have a whole generation of babies and infants where their caregivers were annihilated. And many of those kids will grow up with some very severe psychological traumas as a result of it. And that's the tragedy. And maybe that's one of the things that God can lay on our heart that causes us to have compassion to reach out to those children. But those children that often are the victims of war, the deaths of their parents, the loss of their primary caregivers, those people will have trouble with trust. And that's not to say that everyone will have a personality disorder, but many will have trouble with trusting and feeling secure and having inner peace. And that's simply the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And the effects will be felt for generations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of these others.
Avoidant personality disorder is another one that's kind of self-explanatory. People tend to avoid challenges or put themselves in situations where they're going to be asked to do something that they're not real comfortable with. They tend to be highly sensitive to any kind of negative input or feedback. So avoidant people anticipate failure oftentimes, or anticipate and have some anxiety about new experiences, and tend to avoid and withdraw. They don't want to put themselves in a position where they might be judged or scrutinized by anyone else. Mm-hmm. So they tend to isolate themselves and so avoid almost all social situations.
Mm-hmm. Would this person be likely to be in church?
If they are, they would absolutely not put themselves in a position where they would ever be called on to read, for instance. They would typically avoid the intimate circumstances. Mm-hmm. If they went to a Sunday school class where people took turns reading a passage or whatever, they may leave and never come back.
Mm-hmm.
It's that distressing.
They want to be a wallflower, essentially.
Right. Okay. And maybe as long as we can allow them to do that, they may be able to be comfortable or come and get something out of witnessing a service or whatever, but they're going to be highly sensitive to anything that would call attention to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So.
Histrionic personality disorder is another one we haven't talked about, and probably most of us have seen people like that. When you go to church and you find the most flamboyant person that you can find, you may have found a histrionic person. Histrionic people draw attention to themselves. They're often surrounded by drama. And so it's not so much in the same way that the narcissist needs to be loved by everyone, but they just put on a show. Mm-hmm. And they don't necessarily care what the audience looks like. It's not as selfish as and self-referential as the narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
But dressing in unconventional ways and big hats and lots of colors and, you know, unusual clothing and whatever. Then the other thing is that in the personal lives of a person that's histrionic, there's just lots and lots of drama. Everywhere you turn, there's some crisis, there's some big deal, and there's always the big deal.
They don't take anything in stride.
No, everything is a big deal. Life is a big deal. Every day is a big deal. That's one of the ways that you kind of pick up on some of those kinds of characteristics. They tend to be pretty shallow and pretty superficial, though, when it comes to actually relating or sustaining a relationship, as is the case with almost all the personality disorders. Shallow and superficial, or if not avoidant, you know, are some of those kinds of characteristics. Or, like we talked about with the borderline, highly intense but difficult to sustain.
Mm-hmm. All right. Passive-aggressive.
Ooh, that one's a tough one.
You see that a lot in workplaces, don't you?
Uh-huh. And probably some of the workplace shooters have been passive-aggressives.
Okay.
That passive-aggressive people will tell you what you want to hear to your face and stab you in the back, you know, when you turn around. So they may be very cordial, very polite. They may be very socially appropriate. And some of them just sabotage you. And they will do everything they can to turn around and make you look bad. Some of them literally sabotage. They literally will wreck the machinery or, you know, cause the company trouble or embarrass the company because of some slight or hurt or offense that they believe, you know, has been, you know, committed against them. Mm-hmm. So they get even, but they don't announce it. They don't tell you, I'm going to get even. They just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And may even cover their tracks.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that procrastination can be a tool,
uh-huh.
that a worker's given an assignment and they procrastinate, don't do it. And then perhaps later if they're called to account, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. They've always got a way to deflect. They don't want direct confrontation, but they just want to do these little crazy-making things that irritate and bother everybody and create problems.
Right. one of the theories, I mean, and again, some people who do this may have some insight into their behavior, but we suspect that others often do not. And so a person who's and again, we use the term passive aggressive to describe people who, you know, don't say the truth to your face. And, mm-hmm. you know, even we may use that term to describe people who gossip about you behind your back. They don't ever complain. They don't ever tell you they have a problem with you, but then they'll tell other people they have a problem with you. That's not necessarily a personality disorder, although it could be. Mm-hmm. The most severe forms of this are, you know, people who really do hurtful, troubling, you know, really ugly, ugly things to others. And they may deny that they have any hostility at all. Mm-hmm. So literally, they may not be aware or be able to put into words their hostile or negative feelings towards someone, but they act them out instead. And that's where they can sometimes be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think we all have encountered people with personality disorders. Let's see. One of the personality disorders, I'm trying to remember which one it was that I read about just in the last couple of days, that one of these was, and I'm trying to think, maybe it was borderline personality disorder. That borderline personality disorder, there's about 2% of the population that might meet that criterion. So 2 out of 100 people, you know, and some of the others are less frequent than that. But if we get 1,000 people together, we've got several personality disorders in the group. Now, again, some of these kind of select out of social gatherings. So we're going to see fewer of some of these because they just don't come mm-hmm. around a group. They don't come to church, for instance. But some of the others of these, they will be present. And they will be present in varying degrees. And so there's varying levels of severity of impairment mm-hmm. by these disorders. The ones that are the most hurtful are the ones that we miss and we misdiagnose and we fail to recognize. And sometimes you don't know you got one until they got you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're feeling the sting or, you know, the sabotage or the hostility or the shift from idealizing you one minute to hating you another minute. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, all of us have probably encountered people with these disorders. Anyone in the helping professions. If you're a clerk in a store, you've been encountered by some of these people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some of them are the wallflowers that will never tell you that what I bought is broken. You know, on the other hand, some of these people will rake you over the coals and try as best they can to embarrass you or shame you or, you know, whatever. And some will deliberately sabotage your store as a result of what the broken product that they got that mm-hmm. may have been an accident.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Doty, there's just a wide spectrum, and we've got these that would fit the criteria for this where it's so pervasive and so life complicating, and then you've got, you know, multitudes of individuals with just varying traits and idiosyncrasies and that type of thing, but they don't come under the full-blown diagnosis. So a pastor trying to lead a congregation, what advice do you give them when they've got all these potential, you know, problematic issues in their church, among their congregants?
Leaders, I think, have that very unique responsibility to keep the flock healthy, to keep the congregation healthy, to identify troubled people who may harm others or who may create an unsafe environment for other people. So if we begin to pick up on or begin to hear rumors about someone behaving in antisocial ways, I mean, they are not conforming to the biblical standard that our church upholds. They may be doing illicit and immoral things. I mean, I think clearly we as a church have to confront that. And either we get some kind of an acknowledgement or some kind of repentance. And even then, if it's a personality disorder, you won't know whether or not they're truly repentant until there's some passage of time. The person who has a true antisocial personality disorder may lay low for a while, only to come back to life again later. Antisocial people may be promiscuous and sexually acting out in your church. You know, you confront them with it and they, you know, seem to repent, but then they turn right around and you hear more rumors. Mm-hmm. When you truly find a person who is unrepentant and harming others, then there clearly have to be some boundaries. And so, literally, you may have to forbid a person that's sexually acting out from being in mixed groups. I mean, you may have to ask them to stay in men's groups or men's Bible studies, mm-hmm. you know, to do things to kind of limit their access to the congregation.
Sure. Especially if they're acting in a predatorial way.
Right. And eventually, there may come that point where we've gone to them, we've attempted to set some boundaries, we've, you know, they've agreed, then we find they're not following the boundaries, and ultimately, they may have to be asked to leave the church. We don't get to that point easily, but, you know, I think that's absolutely a reasonable thing to do. If a person continues to steal from others, we eventually may have to point out that that behavior is occurring. Now, we live in a litigious society, and so today, if you point out that you have someone that's behaving in that way, you have to be careful that you do it in a way that ultimately, you know, doesn't get retaliation. But that's the other mark of persons with personality disorders, particularly borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, you know, histrionic, you know, narcissistic. Those people will tend to strike out. They tend to get mm-hmm. back at you, passive-aggressive personality disorder. So some of those people will respond in a hostile manner when they are caught or when they are confronted. And so sometimes you even need legal counsel to figure out yeah. how you're going to address their problem behavior. And if you're going to ask them to leave the church, how do you do it in a way that doesn't violate their civil rights or open the door to a lawsuit?
Mm-hmm. And churches need to have some bylaws that give them good procedures to follow so that it's not simply an arbitrary knee-jerk reaction.
Right. And I think that's what gets people in trouble is if we're not consistent in the way in which we behave. If we have someone who is behaving, you know, in an irresponsible manner or a harmful manner or is promiscuous or whatever, and we permit it in one case and we discipline against it in another, then we clearly have opened ourselves up to criticism and scrutiny for being arbitrary and capricious in the way that we've handled it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that boundaries is a real important issue. Can we get boundaries with these people? With a person with a true narcissistic personality disorder, frankly, I would expect that once those persons are confronted, they probably will become angry and probably will leave the church. They simply do not have an ability to incorporate any kind of negative feedback or what they perceive to be criticism. And there's such an arrogance and attitude of superiority that they really believe that they are superior to you and that they're right and you're wrong. Mm-hmm. So some of these people, in all likelihood, once discovered and confronted, they'll eliminate themselves. They simply won't continue. Mm-hmm. Or they continue to be even more overt in some of their behavior, at which point you just have to ask them to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, narcissistic people who are gathering a following basically to split the church have to be addressed in a pretty rapid manner to put mm-hmm. a stop to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've got this whole spectrum of individuals that would be proactive and aggressive and that type of thing. And then you've got seemingly at the other end of the spectrum, we might use the term chronically struggling, limping, wounded, needy type of things. And I've seen situations in pastoral situations where a pastor just frustrated to no end because of the excessive dependency. But when people seemingly really want to receive help, you know, I found it so helpful when I was in pastoral ministry here in Tulsa that we had your association, your organization, as a resource. And I was never afraid to say, you know what, I feel like I've done everything I can to help you. I'm kind of at the end of my resources here, and maybe there's someone that we know who can help you better than we can. And we were so thankful to have a good Christian counseling agency in town. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, when pastors are dealing with some of these things, at what point should they enlist the partnership and cooperation of a Christian counselor? Many times, Dr. Doty, and you may remember this, I just pick up the phone and call you guys,
right,
and say, you know, this is what we're dealing with, and, you know, and then you were, in some case, simply coaching us a little bit.
Right.
And I found that very, very helpful. What can pastors do?
Here locally, we make that service available to pastors and churches. With 12 staff members, there's almost always someone that will be available within a short period of time that can return a phone call to a church that's dealing with a desperate or a difficult situation. Many times I've been asked to come to elder meetings or deacon meetings to figure out what should we do, what kind of a treatment plan do we develop, you know, for dealing with someone, you know, who's very, very troubled in our church and causing difficulty. So sometimes we'll be asked to come and become consultants to the leaders as they develop a plan. Obviously referring people to a professional counselor. So those of you that are outside of Tulsa, those of you that are in other cities, maybe smaller cities, if you do not have a professional Christian counselor in your church, then I would encourage you to get to know the closest Christian counseling center in your area. You know, wherever that might be, whether it's in your city, whether it's, you know, in a city away or a few miles away, get to know who's out there, who can be those kinds of consultants. Even make an arrangement in advance that they would be willing to consult you and advise you when you come to a, you know, place where you need advice. And most Christian counselors aren't going to charge the kinds of fees that some other professionals might charge, you know, and many will do it simply as a service. But even if you have to buy the hour of a professional's time for their advice, it may be cheap by comparison to the trouble that can be caused by not handling these situations well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much. I just always found it so helpful to work with these things in a collaborative way. Right. You talked about the need sometimes to even contact an attorney because of legal things. And many times, you know, your organization is known as Christian Family Institute. Many times when you're dealing with a situation in your church with someone with a, you know, very troubled situation, very troubled past, personality disorder, whatever, it's not the person who's troubled who's going to approach you. It's going to be the family member. It's going to be the spouse. Who's reaching out for help. And so to be able to form a collaborative team, when we would refer people, we would never dismiss them to the counselor, but we would maintain a pastoral role with them while the professional counselor was also engaged. And I used to liken it to, because I know sometimes people would say, well, we shouldn't need an outside professional. The shepherd should be able to do everything. And my thought always was, well, a good shepherd knows when to contact a veterinarian.
Right.
Because a veterinarian can do some things for livestock that a shepherd can't or won't. A shepherd is more of a general practitioner typically. So we're always thankful for your help and assistance.
And I think even when you make a referral to a professional counselor, those counselors operate by a code of ethics, and it's usually even dictated to them by state law. And so, for instance, clients have the right to confidentiality. But we like to work with pastors and church staff and may even ask that a client be willing to sign a consent that allows us to work together as a team, that allows us to collaborate, that as the church wants to know, how's this family doing, we can give them at least a little bit of information.
Mm-hmm.
We don't feel the need to tell all of the details of
right.
the story, but at least so the church can know they're continuing to come or they're making some progress. Without that client's consent, however, we can't share that information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important right up front for the church to be able to say, we would like for you to sign a release so that we can continue to work together as a team to help you.
Mm-hmm. I even a few times would come with the client to mm-hmm. the initial meeting, and to them that was kind of a comforting situation that it wasn't just a cold turkey transition, but we were able to kind of segue a little bit more gracefully into that by having a pastor accompany the client at the client's request, of course, not our forced thing, but at the client's request, we would come and sit in on the first meeting, and then by the end of the first meeting, they would I never was asked to come back to a second one. They were comfortable then to continue with the counselor.
It wasn't because we were offended by you, Tony. We just
right. I just never got invited back. Client,
well, I think there are those clients that really are find that extremely helpful. Again, back to some of the diagnoses, the dependent client, you know, or the people who are avoidant. Those are people who are going to be reluctant to trust someone else, and so coming with them kind of helps make the transfer to another helping person. Mm-hmm. And so our group, because we've worked to train pastors and train others, and because supervision is something that we do in our group, we love to have pastors come with clients. And some clients really like the fact that their pastor cares enough to come and mm-hmm. introduce them to us and work with us. You may find some groups that are not as comfortable or as familiar with that model, but it doesn't hurt to ask, mm-hmm. you know. And so if you have a Christian counselor in your area and you have a client you want to bring and the client would be more likely to come because you're coming with them, then that counselor may be open to your coming for that first time to make that introduction.
Mm-hmm. We talked about books and other resources earlier. And one book I remember, and it's not really written on a clinical level. It's really kind of a lay-level read. I think the Parrots wrote a book called High Maintenance Relationships. And they talked about, you know, different people that made it difficult to maintain a relationship. Right. So there is it's just good to be educated. It's good to know and understand as much as we can about human nature. Obviously, the Bible is our core spiritual book and that type of thing. But we also appreciate things that have been learned through observation and working with individuals to know, you know, some of the traits and the groupings and the characteristics and all that. So
I'm sure glad to have a physician who has studied and has learned about how to treat illness. I don't want to try to figure that out myself. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, in the area of psychology, there are some useful things. I think Christians have always struggled with how do we decide what we can keep and what we should throw away. Psychology doesn't offer answers to questions about the reason for our existence or the purpose for our life, but it does offer some insight into troubled behavior or maladaptive behavior or psychological disorder. And that's an area where we value some of the insights from psychology.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Doty, we're going to put your information on top of the CDs and that type of thing, but just in case somebody's listening to this on the internet or by an MP3, something or other that doesn't have that in printed form, tell us the name of your organization again, the contact, the website, all that type of thing.
Christian Family Institute is the name of our group. We've been in Tulsa for over 30 years, and so you can find us on the web under Christian Family Institute of Tulsa.
That would be a Google search.
Uh-huh, Google okay. search will find us.
And your actual URL
ChristianFamilyInstitute.com is literally, you know, our website, and we'd be happy to help in any way we can.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Doty, thank you. And again, we just want to stress, like we did at the in the first CD, that this is all meant to be very general in nature. It's not meant to enable you to provide some specific diagnosis of some person. But we encourage you, if you are dealing with a situation that you are inclined to believe might be beyond your level of skill or expertise, you know, consult a professional. Get somebody in who can help you, work with you in the situation. But Dr. Doty, I think this has been enormously helpful. I think it's going to be very...
One other group, Tony, that I have a real compassion for and may have listened to these are those who have been wounded by others, maybe leaders or even parents or caregivers who have a personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And it may very well be that you have been treated in ways by these leaders in your life and have been wounded by it. And I think maybe it may be helpful to you to know about these personality disorders, that obviously some of that behavior is not your fault. These are troubled people who have probably hurt and injured lots of other people. And if you're having difficulty getting over the wounds, it may be also that a counselor can help you kind of figure out how to go on and go forward and how to be safe and how not to be the target of more of this for the future.
You know, that's such a good point. I'm glad you brought that out, because so many people are, you know, we've talked about the personality disorders. But we've not talked a tremendous amount about the victims of those with personality disorders. And I think there's pretty much a widespread tendency for those individuals to, you know, feel like there's something wrong with them. They've allowed their identity to be formed by this very dysfunctional and toxic relationship, and so now they feel like they are somehow inferior, or I'm sure a number of
issues. When it happened by a powerful person in your life and an extremely influential person in your life, there is that tendency to not trust others, because this person did that to me, that I'm not inclined to want to get very close or trust other people. And that's not necessary. Particularly, again, there may be help for how to sort out who's safe and who's not. Mm-hmm.
People carrying guilt and all that. So, well, very good.
Thanks, Tony.
Dr. Doty, thank you. We appreciate this great interview on personality disorders.